Is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. As the humanitarian crisis grows in Gaza and Israel faces pressure at home and abroad to finalize a ceasefire and hostage release deal, House Speaker Mike Johnson making a surprise visit to Israel. ABC's Ian Pannell has more.
He will be meeting with officials. Obviously, the position of Congress kind of matters in terms of support. There has been some wavering. For example, we saw Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's this kind of hardcore congresswoman in terms of the MAGA movement, saying that Israel is guilty of genocide in Gaza. And I think there is pressure from the MAGA movement within the Republican Party. So it'll be interesting to see what the optics are of this meeting.
An Israeli official tells ABC News Israel's prime minister now looking to use military force to get Hamas to release all remaining hostages. In Montana, authorities say the manhunt continues for the suspected gunman who killed four people Friday inside a bar at the Anaconda Deer Lodge. This is ABC News. New tariffs on overseas imports are expected to kick in this week. Economists say those hikes will get passed on to U.S. businesses likely and also ultimately American shoppers. Here's ABC's Morgan Norwood.
Let's start with where it hits the most, and that's going to be the grocery store. Look, the U.S. just doesn't produce enough of the pantry staples like bananas, coffee, grains, fish, so expect prices to rise there. Companies like Hershey, Procter & Gamble, behind many of the snacks that we love, medicines and cleaning products, already warning of hikes. Alcohol, that is also on the list. Imports like French wine and European beer could spike as much as 30% by September.
An independent watchdog agency opening a new federal probe against special counsel Jack Smith for possible violations of the Hatch Act. Smith led criminal investigations against President Trump. A new study shows some students ages 10 to 17 lose nearly an hour each day of school time due to cell phone usage. That study, published in JAMA, found smartphone use focused on social media apps. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
It's fun to look back and laugh now.
That was a bad day.
There are marriages that have died on less. Our first actual fight as a married couple was about the house rules of playing Monopoly. We've not really played Monopoly since. When you can modify an app, you can modify the rules of the game. Maybe there are times when you are better off just playing the computer. Play something else with your spouse instead.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day, when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at MDA75.org.
As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Charlie Pittman. A new report shows Wisconsin again falls behind the national average in per-pupil spending for public schools. Experts say a two-year funding freeze in the current state budget ensures the decline will continue. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum study shows the state spent less than $15,000 per student in 2023, nearly 10% less than the national average. Joellen Pauls is a retired Middleton Cross Plains special education teacher. She says the state of public school funding in Wisconsin is an ongoing crisis that the current state budget guarantees will continue.
There is no per pupil increase for 2 years. No increase. That's a funding freeze. And that puts a lot of districts in a hard place scrambling to determine how do we even just get through this school year.
Among Midwestern states, Wisconsin ranked first in per-pupil spending on public schools back in 2002. According to the report, its ranking has since dropped to seventh among Midwestern states and 26th nationwide. In the past 5 years, more than half of Wisconsin's public schools have held referendums to allow districts to increase property taxes to cover basic costs for schools. Pauls says where those referendums have failed, districts face difficult decisions about increasing class sizes and reducing staff.
Honestly, it's an insult to the students in our public schools. And for lack of a better word, it's irresponsible. It's a shirking of our legislators' duty to our communities and to our state's future.
She says student mental health support and special education continue to be poorly funded in the current state budget. Wisconsin was also grappling with losing $72 million due to a federal K-12 funding freeze, but administration officials now say they plan to release those funds. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Still some air quality concerns thanks to wildfire smoke. Look for mostly sunny skies across the area to develop today. Highs in the lower 80s, a south breeze. For tonight, mostly clear skies. Lows will drop into the upper 50s. Right now, it's 76.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us Monday for an important show. Measles is on the rise. Vaccinations are down. We talk to the folks at Wisconsin Watch and what that means for you. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX. La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast, all things rule of law related, government related, justice related. In this, the second hour, we're going to be talking about redistricting and, yes, gerrymandering and things going on in Texas and Louisiana and the Eighth Circuit and maybe in California and Illinois and New York as well. Much in the focus of our nation in this weekend and in the days just ahead. We're also going to talk about tariffs and the intersection between what the president has been doing in one of his major initiatives of his presidency, imposing, withdrawing, delaying, imposing again tariffs as a part of our international policy, our economic policy. Believe it or not, a federal court is now weighing in on that issue as well. And then we're also going to be talking about birthright citizenship yet again, as appeals courts now also weigh in where the Supreme Court did not. All of that coming up in this hour of Amicus, a law review. You, as always, can be a part of this by sending to Max, my producer, or me a comment in the studio chat line of Civic Media, or also calling in at 855-752-4842. Let's begin with what's going on in Texas and the implications for the rule of law and justice generally. The legislature, as you know, in Texas, just this past week, unveiling a redrawn map reconstituted for the state's United States House districts, proposing to carve up 5 seats. Those are Democratic seats, so that Republicans would now be likely to win them in 2026, November of 26, when all members, all 435 members of the House of Representatives are up for election. The proposed maps would propose to provide 5 House representatives in seats that would include Houston and Dallas and along the United States-Mexico border. The redrawn map, condemned by Democrats, not surprisingly, and many others around the country as a badly partisan map, also racially discriminatory, which is very important to understand as we talk through this, at what's really a rare mid-decade redistricting. As you know, here in the state of Wisconsin, other states throughout the nation, all states, every time a census is done, they look again at their lines inside their particular state and decide whether or not the lines need to be redrawn to ensure, at least the aspiration is, that there is not unconstitutional, shouldn't be political gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering, that people's voice should be heard when it comes to the people we send to Congress in Washington, D.C., and also, of course, the people we send to the state houses in our state capitals around our country. Pushed for months by President Trump and accepted by the governor there, his name is Greg Abbott, as you know, and other Republican leaders, fulfilling what is generally viewed as the president's demand for five additional Republican seats that he can count on that would help the party keep control when, in fact, all of us go to the polls in early November of 2026 to vote for those 435 members. The president pressing Republicans in the legislature, also in Missouri and Indiana and elsewhere, to follow this lead of Texas. And indeed, Texas is taking the lead. We know that just this past week, the members of the legislature began to have some discussions of a formal nature to discuss this plan, which is out there, which would accomplish, again, these major changes, merging the 35th and 37th districts and accomplishing what could be a political gerrymander, but also, according to some, a racial gerrymander. And indeed, there are allegations that merging the 35th and 37th districts is an illegal voter suppression of Black and Latino votes in Central Texas. And that from the representative named Greg Cesar, who is one of those who is sent to Congress in that one of those districts, along with another representative named Lloyd Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T. They may be forced to run against each other by virtue of this redistricting plan. It appears that the legislature there is going to go ahead and vote on this as soon as this coming week. It is developed in consultation with a national districting trust group. It's a Washington-based group. It could well give Republicans control of 30, count them, 30 of the state's 38 House seats, putting about 80% of the delegation Republican control. In the 2024 election, for what it's worth, Donald Trump carried the state with 56%. Of course, again, it's got to be approved by the committee as it reviews that, then by the full House, the full Senate. All of that is moving forward even this weekend, certainly in the coming week, and likely that there'll be legislative action to redraw the lines mid-term, mid-decade, if you will, in Texas, to redraw lines in a way that arguably, depending upon how this is done, how you construe it, would accomplish a partisan gerrymander by changing the Democratic and Republican weightings in those various districts, but also arguably a racial gerrymander. And that is significant, of course, because the Supreme Court has said to us that generally the federal courts should not be in the business of reviewing partisan gerrymanders, that of a case several years ago, but can indeed review racial gerrymanders if you're doing this for racial purposes. And we know that the Supreme Court and other courts, the lower federal courts, the district courts, they are in business when it comes to that. So as this gets enacted in high likelihood in the coming week, anticipate a judicial challenge right away into one or more district courts in Texas, probably the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court there, taking this up, arguably ending up in front of the United States Supreme Court. All of this tick-tock, because again, it's got to be in place somehow long before November of next year as we are talking about this and making these changes, likely in August of 25. People have got to know what district they're in. Candidates have got to know this in order for the system to work. Now, why is this so significant, and why does it likely have extensions not just in those other areas that the president has encouraged, Missouri, Indiana, and other places, but we know that the Supreme Court has also weighed in part, or at least dipped its toe into the lake of a case coming out of Louisiana. This is Louisiana versus Calais. We've talked a lot about it. It is a redistricting case coming out of Louisiana. It has to do with the legislature's creation there of two majority Black districts upon the direction of a lower district and appellate court in that part of the world. And curiously, out of the 65 cases that the Supreme Court decided in this past term on its regular merits docket, the Supreme Court specifically did not resolve the challenge to this Louisiana redistricting matter brought by people who maintained that the redistricting accomplished a violation of the Voting Rights Act by inappropriately placing too much emphasis upon race and creating two black majority districts. The Supreme Court on Friday of this past week returned to this Louisiana case by expanding the scope of this Louisiana congressional redistricting dispute that has been pending for months. And specifically, the Supreme Court, again weighing in here in Louisiana, ordered new briefing on a legal question that is implicated in all of these jurisdictions, that is the strength of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The court issued an order specifically asking the lawyers in this case, it didn't send it back. It said, as you come back and argue this case, give us more briefs, write more on this issue of whether in seeking to comply with the 1965 Voting Rights Act that, again, protects minority voting rights and language rights as well, Louisiana, the Louisiana legislature, in creating these two majority black districts, violated the Constitution's 14th and 15th Amendments, both of them, of course, enacted after the Civil War, and doing that to ensure that black voters were treated equally under the law. Is that, in fact, a violation of the Constitution? And again, there's a lot to unpack here. If the court rules that the state did violate the Constitution by creating those two majority black districts, by affording more people in Louisiana, people of color, the opportunity to have their voices heard, it would mean that states cannot cite the need to comply with the Voting Rights Act if they raise race as a consideration during the map drawing process. There's a lot to unpack there. The upshot is that this Louisiana matter may well, once again, implicate the legitimacy of the Voting Rights Act, which has been around since 1965, arguably to be invoked as soon as next week in Texas, neighboring state there, when it redescribes its lines, maybe on a partisan basis, maybe on a racial basis. And the matter in Louisiana right now appears to put the constitutionality of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act back in play. We have spoken a lot about Sections 4 and 5 and 2 of the Voting Rights Act in the past. You know well that in a case called Shelby County way back in 2013, the Supreme Court, removed a major tool of the Voting Rights Act that required prior approval to change the ways in which voting is done in those areas of the country, around the country, not just in southern states, that have a history of engaging in violations of voting rights. That was Shelby County. In a case called Brnovich, 2021, coming out of Arizona, they further weakened Section 2, which is the core provision of the Voting Rights Act that ensures or should ensure that people of color have the right to vote. Brnovich, Shelby County, maybe now followed up by this Louisiana matter that they will take up again in this second time, this repeat term coming up, the 2025-2026 term coming out of Louisiana, maybe affecting and diminishing once again the strength of the Voting Rights Act. Now, why is this further important? Because we know that in another matter, yet another matter involving the Voting Rights Act, what did the Supreme Court recently do? We talked about this recently as well. This comes out of the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, basically the breadbasket states right in the middle of our nation, telling the Eighth Circuit that it had to stand down, cannot enforce its finding in a case involving two tribes in North Dakota, Native American tribes of that state, who alleged that there was redistricting that compromised their voting rights in that state. The Eighth Circuit finding that the tribes could not bring the lawsuit to begin with because only the Department of Justice can litigate under the Voting Rights Act. That's what the Eighth Circuit found. Contrary to the law, ever since 1965, the Eighth Circuit, a standalone district, and interestingly, appropriately, our Supreme Court, as a part of its emergency docket, told the Eighth Circuit it's got to stand down, that ruling cannot go forward, but plainly indicating that there will be more action coming out of that ruling of the Eighth Circuit, finding that there can be no enforcement of the Voting Rights Act by private entities, private individuals, only the Department of Justice, and yes, indeed, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice can litigate, can prosecute civilly under the law. That's a lot. But it means that an awful lot is in play right now when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, that the Texas matter, the challenges made also by other governors in California and Illinois and in New York to do the same thing, to redistrict, all of that placing the Voting Rights Act and redistricting in the rule of law attention of our nation once again. When we come back, some final comments about that, and then we'll move on to tariffs and, yes, again, birthright citizenship. Stay with us for all of that discussion.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
Are you ever questioning when life will slow down? Are you ever thinking of just relaxing and enjoying the simple things? All of this is possible, even while still being in the workforce. Worthington, Minnesota is a town growing, yet it's nothing like metro life. Professional and labor jobs, a beautiful lake, bike trails, recreation, acres of public hunting, festivals, and great people. Slow down. We're just a short drive away, so come join us. Worthington, it's worth a look.
That sound? It's your recycling at work. And you can thank a Wisconsin woman for making it happen. Millie Zantow saw a waste sorting system in Japan during a trip in the 1970s. She came home to Prairie du Sac in Sauk County inspired. Her research led to the triangle numbered plastic recycling system we still use today. So can you guess what percent of all the plastics produced in the United States ends up being recycled? 75%? 25%? Or 5%? The answer coming up. Zantow also helped with Wisconsin's recycling laws, along with the opening of one of the first collection centers. But now, are you surprised to learn the answer is just 5% of plastics are recycled? It's according to the group Beyond Plastic. Yet Zantow always believed you don't have to be perfect. You just have to start. There's a smart slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for once again joining me and Max for a discussion of many things in the areas of rule of law and justice, including redistricting and gerrymandering. A lot of focus right now in the state of Texas, the legislature there, very likely in the coming week, redrawing their lines mid-decade, not obliged to do it, but mid-decade redrawing the lines, according to Democrats, unconstitutionally, unfairly, unreasonably, perhaps creating five new districts that would be solidly Republican, limiting the Democratic stronghold on other seats, requiring some members of the Democratic Party there to face off against each other. Plainly going to be facing a lot of challenges coming out of whatever the legislature does in the coming weeks. That joined by the Supreme Court just this past week resurrecting this case out of Louisiana involving Louisiana and Calais. Mr. Calais alleging, along with 1,100 plaintiffs who they identify as non-African-American voters who feel aggrieved by the decision of the legislature there to create two majority black districts. Is that in violation of the Voting Rights Act? Is that in violation, as they maintain, of the 14th and 15th Amendments? The Supreme Court directing new briefing on those questions just this past week, even as the Eighth Circuit matter that said, in a matter that the Supreme Court has shut down, that private parties do not have the capacity to go forward and litigate under the Voting Rights Act, the Eighth Circuit law no longer in place, but arguably to be resurrected down the road. In the midst of all of that, coming out of the Texas action, we've got statements by the governors of California, that's Newsom, by Illinois, that's Pritzker, by New York, that's Hochul, all saying if Texas does this, we're going to fight fire with fire, and we're going to redistrict in our states, presumably to create more Democratic seats in those states to send to the Congress in January of 2027. A fascinating, troubling, concerning time to be looking at all of this. And again, TikTok, because all of this has to happen in some way, shape, or form across the country and maybe other states implicated as well, long before you go to the polls in early November of 2026, so that candidates know what districts they're running in, that voters know what districts they live in, so that they can vote in a way that's consistent with our constitutional principles. And yes, indeed, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, if it survives into the years just ahead. In addition to redistricting, which is indeed a rule of law issue, here is one that you may be surprised to hear about. It has to do with tariffs. You know well the president's focus on tariffs as late as this past week, imposing and changing the numbers of tariffs with respect to specific countries around the world. Just this past week, a federal appeals court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, hearing arguments in the Trump administration's appeal of a lower court ruling, which we have talked about, And the question is whether or not the president has the authority to hit all of these foreign nations with 10% tariffs under something called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or the IEEPA. Now, that's not a household word. That's not a household term. I'll say that once again. It's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or the IEEPA. And the reason why this is important, of course, is it means that even this issue, the president's authority to set, impose, to negotiate, to change, to amend tariffs and levies against foreign nations, obviously having an implication for all Americans on the dollars that they pay here in our nation. Can he do that? Well, you know, the Constitution says no. The Constitution plainly gives the right of what? The Congress itself, the legislature, to impose those kinds of tariffs. And that's where the debate begins. The three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of International Trade had blocked the sweeping duties that the president had asserted previously on most countries, and the Federal Circuit had temporarily reinstated the tariffs while it considered the dispute. So what happens here? Well, what happens is that just this past week, the 11 judges, all 11 of them, of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, they're located in Washington, D.C., they have oral argument on all of this. And as the arguments get underway, several judges on the appeals court pepper the Justice Department lawyer about whether the IEEPA, this statute, authorizes the president to impose these tariffs when it's clear that the Constitution says just the opposite. One of the judges immediately noted that the law has never before been used to assess the levies on trading partners, says this we've never seen before. Many others talk about the laws that regulate trade that include the word tariff. One of the judges saying it's interesting to him that here the IEEPA doesn't even say tariffs and doesn't even mention tariffs. And pointing to those trade statutes, which impose constraints on the duties that a president can assess here, one of the judges goes on to question why a president would rely on those laws when the IEEPA provides broader power under the Justice Department's interpretation. Again, it's a lot. It's a lot going on here. One of the judges says it's a wholesale revision of the scheme that Congress enacted. It's really kind of asking for an extraordinary change to the legislature's approach to the tariff schedule. And the upshot of all of that is, of course, that we've got members of this panel saying that they're very doubtful of the president's capacity to do this under the Constitution and under this particular statute. Other members of the Federal Circuit seem concerned about the breadth of the authority the president is claiming under the IEPA to impose those broad tariffs, and talking about unbounded authority of the president. When you come back, I'll tell you what the government lawyer said in response to that, and again, what the Federal Circuit may well do in telling the president once again what he cannot do in all of this major tariff work that's been occupying our attention in recent months. And when we come back here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. As the humanitarian crisis grows in Gaza and Israel faces pressure at home and abroad to finalize a ceasefire and hostage release deal, House Speaker Mike Johnson making a surprise visit to Israel. ABC's Ian Pannell has more.
He will be meeting with officials. Obviously, the position of Congress kind of matters in terms of support. There has been some wavering. For example, we saw Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's this kind of hardcore congresswoman in terms of the MAGA movement, saying that Israel is guilty of genocide in Gaza. And I think there is pressure from the MAGA movement within the Republican Party. So it'll be interesting to see what the optics are of this meeting.
An Israeli official tells ABC News Israel's prime minister now looking to use military force to get Hamas to release all remaining hostages. In Montana, authorities say the manhunt continues for the suspected gunman who killed four people Friday inside a bar at the Anaconda Deer Lodge. This is ABC News.
A big night for the defense. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NFL, the Packers reviewing video from last night's family night practice. The list of injured players now up to about half a dozen who did not participate, including tight end Tucker Kraft. He's now got a groin injury. A big night, though, for safety Omar Brown, who was with the Broncos last season. Brown with three interceptions last night and talked about his first impressions of being in Green Bay.
When you get here, you kind of automatically see, like, the tradition they have here. I love all the fans. They just super nice, and they all support us.
Matt LaFleur Fleur on Omar Brown.
He's making plays. You want to see how guys respond and react when they get those opportunities, and he's coming through.
Baseball, the Brewers wrapping up their series with the Nationals after another win, 8-2 last night. But Sal Frelick dealing with an issue, the meniscus in his left knee.
Something about it's right on a suture that he had before. They say it's fairly common. Yeah, when you wrench it a little bit, it flares up on you.
That's the Brewers manager, Pat Murphy, with sports on Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabe. Pamela Anderson has been married five times. Once to Tommy Lee, once to Robbie Ritchie, also known as Kid Rock, twice to a professional poker player, and only one time to some guy named Dan. She must love marriage. One of the few men she did not marry was former Superman actor Dean Cain. Last week, Cain said he and Anderson's relationship fizzled for one reason. I know what you're thinking. It's because she was too busy getting married to other men. But no. But Cain says that's not why. He says things didn't last because he was never into life in the fast lane, and Anderson was. That, along with the fact that she got married every other week, was probably a hindrance. Cain did have a lot of good things to say about Anderson. Pamela Anderson has revived her career and has gotten serious about the craft of acting. She received rave reviews for Showgirl and currently stars in The Naked Gun with Liam Neeson. They were, quote, caught, end quote, on the set of The Tonight Show making out. Yes, the two are dating, unless they've already married by the time of this airing. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Still some air quality concerns thanks to wildfire smoke. Look for mostly sunny skies across the area to develop today. Highs in the lower 80s, a south breeze. For tonight, mostly clear skies. Lows will drop into the upper 50s. Right now, it's 76.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
NFL Hall of Famer, College Football Hall of Famer, Mr. Joe Thomas. You were telling us a little bit about being drafted number 3. You skipped the draft.
I went fishing that day, and I never did it for anything other than I just much rather spend the day fishing with my dad, and I'm hoping that that's a story that keeps being told and gives people a reason. Like, you know what, instead of working today, I'm going to go fishing with my kid. I'm going to make the time because it's impactful. It's memories that they're going to remember for the rest of their life.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station, and on the app.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday morning, Up North News reporter Selena Heller will talk to Jimmy Cuska, Jane Matinair.
And me.
Oh, that's Dr. Kristen Lierley. She'll be here too.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about presidential authority once again and this very interesting oral argument that was had just this past week among the 11 judges of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reviewing a decision of a lower court, the U.S. Court of International Trade, that had blocked these sweeping duties of the presidency, the authority of the president to impose tariffs of all things. And a seeming majority of the bench this past week in the Federal Circuit saying, you don't have the authority to do this, Mr. President. They are met with the argument from the president's attorneys, and those are the attorneys from the Department of Justice who say, well, wait a minute, we're going to be invoking this IEEPA. That is the International Emergency and Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. And what does that say? Well, that says that the president can exercise the authority to do this in instances where there's an unusual or extraordinary threat to national security or the economy for which a national emergency has been declared. Now, in invoking that language, again, the IEEPA just says nothing about tariffs, nothing about levies of this sort. But in rolling out all these tariffs of recent weeks and months, Donald Trump has claimed that trade deficits and the flow of illicit drugs into our country across our borders have constituted this national emergency about which the IEEPA does, in fact, give him some authority. And that's the basis upon which the argument is made by your attorneys in front of the Federal Circuit just this past week that the president does have this authority. The members, the full members, all 11 of them of the court of on the Federal Circuit, the court, they're very skeptical. They haven't issued their decision yet, but probably coming sometime soon. Along the way, here's your piece of civics and your piece of law school as well, which we sometimes incorporate here on the broadcast. In addition to saying that the IEEPA does not authorize Donald Trump to engage in this tariff work, the lawyers for the small businesses and the states that were arguing against his authority also said the actions of the president violate this major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine. There's some basic principles the Supreme Court has variously embraced and sometimes not embraced to prohibit various governmental actions. And what are those mean? Well, under the major questions doctrine, we've seen this in the past, an agency that seeks to decide a major issue that has some political or economic significance, something big, as the Chief Justice has said, and something new, big and new, has to have some clear authorization from Congress. That's the major questions doctrine. Only the Congress can implement those kinds of things. The argument here that the president, not only acting in violation of the Constitution, can't do this. It's big. It's new. And for that reason, major questions prohibits the president from doing this. Second, the non-delegation doctrine. Under that doctrine, Congress cannot, not able to delegate to give its legislative authority to an executive branch agency. Can't say, here, you do this. Unless it sets out an intelligible and understandable, a reasonable, a clear standard, some judicially enforceable principle to guide that agency. Here, once again, saying that the Congress has not given up its authority to impose tariffs. As the Constitution, James Madison and George Mason and others wrote many years ago, non-delegation doctrine says he can't do this. And those doctrines as well seem to be favorably received by the members of the Federal Circuit just this past week. What a decision that would be if indeed they come back and say that all this tariff work, all this initiative underway, even in the hours of recent weeks, cannot go ahead because the president does not have the authority and his reliance on the IEEPA is unfounded. Now, of course, would that go to the Supreme Court? Of course it would. And the government, your Department of Justice, would certainly appeal it promptly to the Supreme Court for its review. But we now have another challenge to a fundamental thing that our president is doing along the way, coming out of the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C. We'll see what they decide, along with other courts out there reviewing the actions of this president. This one having to do with tariffs and the legitimacy, the constitutionality of all of this. Question whether or not our president would follow that, even if this court or another court says, you can't do this, Mr. President. We do have issues in another area where the president has issued an executive order and appears to be moving even this past week in the wake of the stay, the 30-day stay of that major decision in that CASA case, C-A-S-A, in which the United States Supreme Court did not address the issue of birthright citizenship, whether you're born here, whether you therefore have a right to claim citizenship. Or whether he is right, and that if you were born of parents who are illegally here, who are here only temporarily, you are not citizens. The Supreme Court in that major case, the single most important case of this past term, decided not to decide. And although they did say you can't have national injunctions, can't universally impose what one judge or even an appeals court may say across the country, that was their ruling coming from Amy Coney Barrett in that case, the last day of its major decisions. Even though they said that, no national injunctions, we've had a lot of activity in the wake of that. Judges, district court judges, and now appeals court judges also deciding what the Supreme Court did not, and saying across the board, uniformly, universally, that the prior decision of the Supreme Court in the late 19th century, saying that indeed, if you are born here in this country geographically, we don't need to look at your parents' heritage. You are a citizen of the United States of America. That's the precedent of the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court has not overturned. What do we know? We know in the wake of even that decision in CASA, we had district court judges who are saying we're going to go ahead and find that the president's executive order with his restrictive view on the 14th Amendment cannot stand. We know about Judge Joseph LaPlante. He is in New Hampshire who certified a class of all the newborn babies who might be subject to that executive order and said, the class is certified. I'm protecting all of you. You are now all United States citizens. They don't know it yet because, of course, they're babies. They're babies just born since February of this year. We've got another judge. Her name, of course, is Deborah Boardman. She's in Maryland. She's said the same thing, that she is likewise going to do the same kind of thing if, in fact, when she gets a return report and a return order from her court of appeals, she is likewise going to do the same thing. That is Deborah Boardman. She is in the District of Maryland. And then we've got Leo Sorokin, S-O-R-O-K-I-N, just this past week. He's a district court judge in Massachusetts who does the same kind of thing. He says, you know what? The Supreme Court, having not decided this, I'm going to decide it, just like Judge LaPlante and just like Judge Boardman have done. I am finding that if you are born here in the United States of America, you are entitled to citizenship. and not defying the Supreme Court, but saying that that's the way the law should be. At least three district court judges across the country who are making that decision in the wake of the Supreme Court's non-decision on this issue. And now we've got even more judges, and they are at the appellate court level who are coming to the same result. Let's talk about those in the First Circuit and then also in the Ninth Circuit. The First Circuit, just this past week, on Friday, ready to become, believe it or not, the second Court of Appeals in the country to rule that President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship is unlawful. It is unconstitutional. A three-judge panel of the Boston First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, it's in Boston where they sit, spent about 2 hours looking skeptically at Donald Trump's executive order in a series of cases in which, again, many other courts, including those in the First Circuit, have said the executive order violates the Constitution. And in particular, this past week, the chief judge, his name is David Barron, there, B-A-R-R-O-N, of the U.S. Court of Appeals in the First Circuit, says this. He says, we have an opinion of the Supreme Court that we aren't free to disregard. That's Chief Judge David Barron. He's referring to that 1898 Supreme Court case. It is United States versus Wong Kim Ark. In that particular case, coming out of California, you have parents who are of Chinese ancestry and citizenship. They are here in California, in the United States. There is the birth of their son. The question is that son a citizen of the United States of America? And the Supreme Court uniformly, unequivocally says 1898 that their son is a citizen of the United States of America. Why? Because he was born on American soil. Other members of the panel just this past week said they required to stick with the holding in that case. Judge Julie Rickleman, R-A-K-E-L-M-A-N, said that the Trump interpretation is wrong. And the ask that the court adopt the dissenting opinion in that 19th century case simply is not what she is going to do in the First Circuit. She tells the DOJ attorney who's arguing again on behalf of the executive order, she says, we have to apply the majority decision, not the dissenting opinion, almost mocking, if you will, the position of the government attorney. A ruling against the administration here, likely coming from the First Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that the executive order cannot stand, would represent the second time. In addition to all these district courts, you also have appeals courts, the First Circuit, and also even before the First Circuit review of all this, the first time that a Court of Appeals has taken a look at this is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's that huge geographic swath of land, again, on the West Coast, also including Hawaii and Alaska, huge geographic area. That's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It said last month that, again, the Trump executive order cannot stand. And in a separate case, again, coming out of district courts there in the Ninth Circuit, finding that the president's executive order is unconstitutional, contrary to precedent, contrary to the law, contrary to what has been the understanding in America for well over 100 years, arguably even before the decision of the Supreme Court in that Wong Kim Ark case, saying that that cannot stand. So now the likely status is that sometime soon, the First Circuit Court of Appeals is going to join the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in answering the question that the United States Supreme Court did not answer, which is that the executive order cannot stand and that indeed the law is and should remain as it has been for all of recent history. And that is that children born this year in the wake of the executive order, they are babies born even of parents who are illegally here, who are here temporarily. All of that cannot stand. All of that, a part of what the appeals courts are doing and all of that a part of what the judges in America are assigned to do as they undertake the work and the initiatives, taking up these challenges to the president's decisions. When we come back in our final segment, some comments from at least one caller about many of the topics we've discussed today, and then also some observations about other things going on in the courts of our land as Amicus Law Review continues.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. With Governor Tony Evers choosing not to run for a third term, that means we're going to have the first open race for governor in 16 years. We already know who some of the candidates will be. On the Democratic side, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez launched her campaign, and Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley said he's running. On the Republican side, Washington County Executive Josh Shoman and Southeastern Wisconsin Business Executive Bill Berrien are running. Many more are expected to join the race. And it's not just governor that will have an open race. We could see open races for attorney general, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and state treasurer, too. Couple that with what's happening in the state legislature, no longer under gerrymandered maps, the year 2026 is going to bring a rather unique moment for voters in Wisconsin to determine the path forward on a fresh new era for the state. I know some can be wary of change, but let's embrace this as the real opportunity that it is.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Americans really like voting by mail and in-person early voting. That, according to 2024 statistics from the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. According to EAC, 158,211,780 citizens voted out of 211,144,275 active registered voters, a 74.8% turnout, 3 points lower than 2020. Among the 158 million voters, 52.8 million voted in person on Election Day. But far more Americans voted early, with 46.8 million voting early by mail and almost 48.9 million voting early in person. Mail-in voting accounted for 30.3% of votes cast, with some states offering universal mail balloting or permanent mail or absentee lists. Over 15 million ballots were returned via drop boxes in 36 states, up 10% since 2022. The percentage of in-person Election Day voters dropped in 2024 to only 37.4%, while in-person early voting jumped to 35.2%. The combination of mail and early in-person totaled 65.5%. It's clear that early voting is here to stay. We've linked to the report at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This is the final segment of our two-hour program this weekend. Appreciate your attention. Appreciate your engagement on all of these issues. And yes, as I say with increasing frequency, it's a lot. It is a lot to digest. I appreciate that very much. I appreciate your interest in the civics aspect of these issues, in the law school stuff that we do on this radio broadcast as well. It is perhaps the one good thing that comes out of all of these challenges to the president's executive orders and other machinations coming out of this administration, that we also learn more about our judicial system, about how courts work, about the processes, the rules, the procedures, and even the doctrines that they apply on a regular basis. Appreciate your attention, acknowledging that it is a lot. We also appreciate here in our broadcast the comments and the involvement of all of our listeners, and that includes Mark, who calls in and also reports to us on the studio chat line about two of the issues we've discussed this weekend, and those include redistricting and gerrymandering. And about that, Mark notes that race and partisan politics are still entwined intimately, and goes on to note that it is interesting coming out of Louisiana that in the 4th District, Mike Johnson, of course, who is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, it is his district that is somewhat the focus of that Louisiana case that we talked about. The case is still before the Supreme Court when it comes to deciding whether a newly drawn map that includes two majority black districts should stand. Mark notes that it is 4th District. It's Mike Johnson's district. It resembles the very original gerrymander up there in Massachusetts coming out of Eldridge Gerry's governorship at the time, and the cartoon of great fame that gives life to this notion of gerrymandering. Mark, appreciate very much your comment about not only the history here, but also about the fact that when it comes to Louisiana, comes to Texas, maybe comes to these other states, including California and Illinois and Missouri and Indiana, who knows how far this is going to go as we take up once again the issue of line drawing and gerrymandering in the nation. Some of it may be partisan, some of it may be racial. It's all intertwined. And that is Mark's point. And that certainly is one of the things with which courts need to wrestle. What is the nature of this line redrawing? What are the reasons for our doing it? And it affects dramatically the results. Mark also comments upon tariffs and notes, as we have noted here repeatedly, including in our weekend broadcast here, that the Constitution, he says, it's pretty clear. It is indeed pretty clear, Mark, that the Congress has the power to set tariffs. The way that the president is doing it, he says, is essentially taxation without representation. Mark goes on to say the founders were concerned, as discussed in various letters of the Federalist Papers, about a president setting policy for personal gain, and these tariffs fall in that category. Mark, appreciate very much your commentary about the authority of the president to impose these tariffs as we have seen them in recent months and weeks. Appreciate those comments, Mark, and appreciate the comments and the involvement of all of you here on our broadcast. A final note also about the work of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We talked about them just a few moments ago in connection with their affirmation of the traditional meaning and purpose of the 14th Amendment. Just late Friday, the Trump administration suffered what can only be called another setback. You may recall well that there was a judge, we talked about her a lot, named Mame Frimpong, F-R-I-M-P-O-N-G. She is in the Federal District Court in Los Angeles. She had decided that the actions of various federal agents in detaining without suspicion, without an appropriate basis, without finding a basis to detain and even arrest people on the streets of Los Angeles cannot stand. On Friday, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals affirms what Judge Frimpong has directed, telling basically the federal agents to stand down, or at least redirecting them to what the law of our nation has always been, that you have to have reasonable suspicion before you detain someone, before you arrest them on the streets of America, including Los Angeles. You can't simply base it upon how they look, upon their employment place, or some other characteristics that are not based upon a reason to believe that they're engaged in some kind of criminal activity. The three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirming the lower court ruling that these kinds of actions relying exclusively on a person's race and some other factors, for example, like speaking Spanish, cannot form the basis for arrests and detentions. And of course, we know that the administration's raids there and the arrests, other things, have been a lot of focus of our national attention. All of that back in the news recently. The appellate judges wrote that the plaintiffs in this case are likely to succeed on the merits. Again, all of this in the nature of preliminary injunctions. They're likely to succeed in showing that federal agents made arrests based on how people looked, how they spoke, and where they lived or worked. And for that reason, they said that activity cannot go on. The civil rights groups that brought this case filed these suits on July 2nd, accusing the Trump administration of these unconstitutional sweeps. Since early June, nearly 3,000 people have been arrested. And that happening before and even in the wake of Judge Frimpong's order. The American citizens and immigrants who are illegal in the United States have been caught in this dragnet. Of course, even if you're not a citizen, you are entitled to the protections of due process and what our constitutional dictates provide. 61-page ruling. The appellate judges said it was likely the arrests were made without reasonable suspicion. And they added that because the arrests were part of a pattern of officially sanctioned behavior, they're likely to recur without court intervention. They have said it cannot go on. It's got to stop. And the Court of Appeals now affirming the lower court, saying you can't do this, likely headed to the Supreme Court again. We've got a lot on our docket of America, a lot on the docket of this broadcast. I thank you once again for staying with me on all of this. And I invite you back again next weekend as we take up the events, the circumstances, the times in which we live under the rule of law here in the United States of America. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Countries are preparing for President Trump's newly announced tariffs to take effect later this week. ABC's Selena Wang has more on reaction.
Our global trading partners, they have been bracing for this moment, and the reaction to President Trump's announcement of those sweeping new tariffs that go into effect next week really range from relief to shock, because we're talking about tariffs that range from 10 to a whopping 40%.
Economists say tariffs likely means higher costs for U.S. businesses and ultimately consumers. House Speaker Mike Johnson making a surprise visit to Israel today. He's expected to meet with Israeli officials in the coming days, with talks centering on a Gaza ceasefire. It comes as the humanitarian crisis grows in Gaza, with aid groups warning of mass starvation. In the southeast and the plains, a lingering flood threat due to severe storms this week. And smoky skies in the Midwest are keeping health alerts in place until midnight. That haze from Canadian wildfires. This is ABC News. Lawmakers in Texas.